Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Workey, Judge Flory, and the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. This case is A201607, State of Minnesota versus Marcus Anthony Baker.
There we go. I am now permitted to unmute myself, and I can greet the attorneys and my colleagues. Good morning. We are here for a remote oral argument, and so I want to say thank you to the parties for being willing to participate in this way. And even though we're not in the judicial center, the same rules would apply. And I want to reiterate a couple of things. First off, before you begin, if you could state your full name and the party that you represent, because as you know, these are being recorded, and that way we're able to, when we listen to the recordings, know who's speaking. Secondly, there's a clock that you should be able to see, and sometimes attorneys have a hard time looking at it if they have toggled into the active speaker view. So if you move to the gallery view, you should see the clock, and you should be able to follow along and know how much time is left. The last thing I want to say is that we hope to keep interruptions to a minimum, but we also understand that given these remote circumstances, there may be from time to time a pet, a family member, a doorbell, and while we try to keep them to a minimum, we will be understanding with you if that happens, or if there's some technical difficulty, we will just let us know, and we'll make sure that you have as much time to argue as you're entitled to. With that being said, are you both prepared to proceed? Mr. Regetz?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
And Mr. Getz?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. You may begin.
May it please the court. My name's Frederick Getz. I represent the appellant Marcus Baker. First, Marcus Baker asks that you reverse his convictions for attempted murder and murder in the second degree outright on the grounds of insufficiency of the evidence. The evidence in this case on the key issue of identification is insufficient as a matter of law. Applying the standard for review for convictions based on circumstantial evidence and viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the state, the circumstances proved are consistent with a reasonable inference that Marcus Baker was not the driver of the van from which the shots were fired that resulted in the death of Sean Jones and injury to Wilbur Jackson. Therefore, the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law and the conviction should be reversed outright. In the alternative, appellant asks that you reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial as a result of errors occurring at the trial in the district court. Those include evidentiary rulings by the district court, most significantly when the district court, reversing itself, in effect, in its pretrial rulings, allowed the state to admit evidence of witness retaliation. And that specific evidence came from a lead detective. The evidence was basically that witnesses and crime victims don't want to be involved or participate because they're afraid that the person who hurt them in the first place would come back and hurt them again. And that's why they don't show up at trial, which blatantly suggested to the jury in this case that a key prosecution witness, Wilbur Jackson, who was the victim of the attempted murder count, did not show up for trial because of that very reason, when there was absolutely no evidence to support that, no evidence that Marcus Baker or anyone associated with him ever threatened this witness. And it only served to unfairly paint Marcus Baker as a person the jury should be afraid of. Additional errors that I'll speak about if I have time involve multiple instances of prosecutorial misconduct, including interjecting the retaliation evidence into trial when the district court had previously ruled it was out without first approaching the court for permission to do that. And then during the final questioning of the key witness, Sergeant Yang, repeatedly engaging in a line of basically giving her final argument during the examination of the witness through leading questions, which was sustained again and again and again. Those errors on their own and certainly in combination were not harmless.
Mr. Getz, I'm going to jump in and stop you for 1 second. As much as I'd like to hear you speak, I think our clock is set for 15 hours instead of 15 minutes. And thank you, Mr. Gratz, for bringing that up. If I could ask the marshal to reset the clock, and I believe, there we go. And I think how much time, I had about 4 minutes is what I thought had run off the clock. So if you would like to make that 11 minutes remaining and we can restart.
So I do appreciate the court's generosity and give me 15 hours to argue my case.
This is not the United States Senate. You will not be speaking that long. Thank you. You can proceed.
Thank you. Let me turn then to the evidence, the issue of insufficiency of the evidence. I think the parties agree that on the central issue of identification, that is based entirely on circumstantial evidence. And as the court knows, there's a two-part test or two-part standard of review that's applied under the Anderson Al-Nassir test. First, this court, as a court of review, must identify the circumstances proved. In this step, the court must give deference to the jury's acceptance of the proof of the circumstances and rejecting any evidence or arguments that conflicted with those circumstances. Then, in the second step, the court must consider whether there is a reasonable inference of guilt that can be drawn from those circumstances proved, viewed as a whole, and whether a reasonable inference inconsistent with guilt can also be drawn from the circumstances proved, again, viewed as a whole. In the second step, it's important that there's no deference given to the fact finder's choice between reasonable inferences. And quoting from the Supreme Court in State versus Harris, to sustain a conviction, the circumstances proved when viewed as a whole must be consistent with a reasonable inference that the accused is guilty and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt. And here the evidence does not withstand scrutiny under that test. Most significantly, when we're looking at the circumstances proved, they do not include that Marcus Baker was in the van at the time of the shooting. In other words, that he was either the principal here or an aider and abettor in the murder of Sean Jones and attempted murder of Wilbur Jackson. In the appellant's brief at page 31 to 35, I try to lay out what I feel is a fair representation of the circumstances proved. I think respondent largely concedes that, quote, appellant accurately sets out most of the circumstances proved. And then the state cites some others.
Mr. Getz, as you're looking at those two lists of circumstances proved, I agree that they're very similar. Do you see any differences between what the state is arguing was a circumstance proved and what you're saying was a circumstance proved?
No, not in terms of the circumstances. I think we have some disagreement as to what you can draw from that. For example, there's some qualitative differences, I would say, with regarding the description of clothing. State characterizes it as distinct. I think it's anything but distinct. So
what is distinct, though, I guess what stood out to me is when Yang testified about Baker's build and his gait. And I thought that was distinctive. Can you talk a little bit about that and why we should disregard that compelling piece of circumstantial evidence?
I appreciate the question, Judge Warkey. It's an important one, but I disagree that it's compelling, and I don't think it really proves anything, because you really have to drill down on what Sergeant Yang said in that circumstance. So Sergeant Yang, first of all, if we can categorize it according to the rules of evidence, it's a lay opinion under 701. There is absolutely no foundation that he had any particular expertise.
Right, it didn't seem that you were objecting or on appeal challenging the admissibility on foundation grounds. I don't think that's right. In the brief at all. So let's just assume that there's enough foundation and we're getting to what he said in his lay opinion. He's viewed known video and has compared the known video to the unknown, and is making some conclusions, drawing some conclusions based on his specific knowledge. And if you're not objecting to foundation, then let's get back to Judge Werke's question, which is why would we disregard that?
Well, first of all, I'm not suggesting this court disregards it, but I think it's of little weight. I think it's little of weight and certainly does not compel the conclusion that there's no rational inference of innocence here. Because what did he say? He said that basically he's viewed these videotapes umpteen numbers of times and found the build and movement and gait of the driver consistent with Marcus Baker. But where are the details, Judge Warkey? Where's the details of that? What is it about the movement? We have absolutely no...
What I did is, when I look at this, and this is what I find hurts your argument, is that I wasn't so impressed with the testimony about the black sweatshirt. I mean, basically, a lot of individuals wear dark clothing. And I didn't find that to be such... of such weightiness, but when that was also considered with the gait and the build, that's what I felt my definition of compelling. I mean, we can't read these in isolation. We have to look at all of the testimony. You'd agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. But let's drill down on it. And I guess the question I would pose back to the court is, what is it about the build? What is it about the movement? What is it about the gait? And there was absolutely no details given about this. Well, can we see here that, well, on this known video of Marcus Baker, he walks with a slight limp, or he puts more weight on his left leg than his right leg, anything distinctive? And you don't. There's absolutely no details. So all we have is this very generic build, movement, and gait consistent with Marcus Baker.
So Mr. Getz, if that testimony were true, if let's assume that we characterize the similarity that Yang observes as a circumstance proved consistent with the verdict, right? That is, now we're saying that they're similar. Who is ruled out under the rational hypothesis standard? We're ruling out what segments of our population as we go through, right? It's people who have these kinds of clothing are in, people who don't would be ruled out, people who have certain characteristics. Who do you think is ruled out by that circumstance if we include in the circumstances proved the Yang's observation and his opinion that it's that this is a similar build and person with similar gait?
Well, if I might correct you, Judge Brian, with all due respect, he never said similar. The word he used was consistent. And what does consistent mean? And I think to get to your question, who do we rule out? We can't rule out that many people at all, because there's nothing about the build, the movement, and gait that are so focused on Marcus Baker that they cannot be consistent with a number of other people. For example, are they consistent with any other brothers that Brandon Baker might have? Are they consistent with Deanna Hill, the woman who owned the apartment and had access to the garages? Are they consistent with the other individual who Officer Baudette had received information from a CRI was somehow perhaps related to this? We don't know. You cannot eliminate any of those individuals because there's just absolutely no information. Focusing on the rest of the evidence, looking at the totality of the circumstances from the surveillance video at the 4091 Geneva, we don't know the race of the individuals, the driver in particular. We don't know their height. We don't know their weight. We don't know if they have any facial hair. None of this. And to get back to Judge Warkey's observation, the clothes are very generic. Gray hooded sweatshirt and tan boots or brown shoes, tan or brown boots. I don't know, probably 90% of the state has brown boots in their closet. So my point is that these are not such distinctive items of clothing where we can say it's the same pattern of design. I can see the same color combination here. There's something distinctive about this clothing that Mr. Baker had that we can see with the driver in this videotape. It's the same person, eliminating all rational hypothesis that it could be wrong and it could be somebody else. So we cannot eliminate a whole host of individuals, Your Honor. But one related point to that, I think it's very important. This is not an alternative perpetrator case where the defense is required to point out any individual and put that individual at the scene. The question before this court is, when you're applying the circumstantial evidence test, can you eliminate any rational hypothesis of innocence, i.e. that they got the wrong guy, it was somebody else? And the answer to the question is no, and that conviction should be reversed. Alternatively, and I just want to focus on just my last minute and 45 seconds, the evidentiary error in admitting the retaliation testimony. It was very clear when that testimony came in that it was all about presenting to the jury that the reason Wilbert Jackson didn't show up for trial was because he had been threatened by Marcus Baker to retaliate against him if he's testified. There was no other implication by that testimony. It came out during the questioning about Wilbert Jackson. There were questions about Jackson before and after that. That was key evidence, and under the MacArthur case, Wambly-MacArthur or Mark Orlando Harris, it's clearly very prejudicial. There was no reason for that evidence to be introduced in this case. Jackson's credibility was not at issue at all. So under the line of cases where it talks about evidence of fear or threats being admissible, this is not that case. This was important evidence. Wilbert Jackson was mentioned 19 times in the state's final argument. Though it's true the state never mentioned, well, he didn't show up because he was retaliated against, the specter of his non-appearance loomed very large. The defense never rebutted that in their closing argument. I'm not saying that was a fault of the defense, and I can understand strategically why they didn't, but that's the reality. It was never rebutted. And so therefore, I think the error was not harmless. Certainly when you combine that with the other areas, errors of prosecutorial misconduct and other trial errors, I think the court should reverse and remand for a new trial if you find that the evidence is sufficient. And I would only, the last point, the evidence is marginal at best, and that bears upon the harmless error analysis as well. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from the panel at this point, and you will have some rebuttal time, Mr. Getz. Mr. Ragatz.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. On appellant's first issue, the insufficiency of the argument of the evidence, the key word in the circumstantial evidence standard review is reasonable. And as appellant acknowledges on page 3 of his reply brief, there has to be some reasonable inference other than guilt. Well, here the jury reasonably found appellant guilty because appellant's conjecture about a different shooter is unreasonable. And that's under the totality of the circumstances. I want to be clear here that I'm not saying there's one smoking gun or key piece of evidence here, but there are four key things to consider here. First of all, the shooter was with appellant's brother at the time of the murder in appellant's brother's van, and appellant was later arrested with his brother. Second, the shooter apparently just happened to dress like appellant. And we're not talking about one item of clothing, we're talking about three items together. This is appellant's look. He wears tan boots, black pants, and a gray hoodie. And not just any gray hoodie, but a gray hoodie with marking on the sleeves. So this isn't some ubiquitous jeans, t-shirt, tennis shoes. This is a unique look that appellant is often seen in and that the shooter just happened to be
what's
wearing.
What's the evidence, Mr. Ragatz, what's the testimony that says he's often seen or this is his look? Because I don't want you to overstate things here, right? I don't want you to overstate the evidence. You ask us to look at the closing arguments to determine the basis for why you don't think there was a prejudicial error. But as you know, the closing arguments aren't evidence. So I want you to point us to specific testimony as you're going through, because I reviewed the record. I didn't see testimony, and maybe I missed it, that this is Mr. Baker's look.
No one used the phrase his look, but the Sergeant Yang described watching all these hours of video of known appellant on the, I think it was on the 19th and the 20th and the 21st, and the jurors saw videos of appellant wearing a gray hoodie, tan boots, and black pants. So this is not something that appellant wore on the night of the murder, and that was it. I mean, indeed, he had at least two pairs of tan boots. He was wearing them when he was arrested, and they found a pair in his apartment, and they found a gray hoodie in his apartment. So again, we're talking about the totality of the circumstances. So you need someone who was hanging out with appellant's brother in appellant's brother's van at the time of the shooting, wearing the same clothing that appellant was wearing around the time of the murder. Those are the first two. The third is and this is very important, I think, that the killers went straight from the murder scene to a garage rented by appellant's, rented by the mother of appellant's child. So you have to have someone else who apparently has some relationship with this woman to go directly there from the murder scene. And then finally, number four is you have the fact that the next morning after the murder, the shooter went from that garage rented by the mother of appellant's child to the Applebee's, where the van that belongs to appellant's brother was abandoned, wearing a red jacket like the red jacket that appellant was wearing when he was arrested later with his brother. So when you put all four of those things together, that's where the totality of the circumstances render unreasonable the conjecture that this was somebody else. And the jurors, that's what the jurors concluded here. The jurors were urged, look at the videos, make up your own mind from the videos. Well, the jurors did that. The jurors essentially made a factual determination that when you put all these videos together, they identify appellant. And again, I'm not saying there's a smoking gun here. I'm not saying there's one video where you can say, hey, that's appellant. I can see him there. But when you look at the clothing and everything else, and I do want to briefly address the testimony about the gait, movement, and build. The weight of that was for the jury. It is beyond dispute that on appeal, you have to assume the jurors believe all of the state's witnesses. Well, the state's witness said, I've looked at all these hours of video and the gait, movement, and build are consistent. He said they're definitely consistent. So that's another factor in the totality here.
Mr. Ragatz, from the standpoint of our rational hypothesis standard, if you have a lay opinion witness who herself or himself is making an inference, right? So the testimony that we have from Officer Yang is itself an inference, a conclusion that he is drawing based on his knowledge. And we are, under the rational hypothesis standard, to give no deference to the inferences that jurors make based on the facts and the circumstances proof. What do you do with testimony that is itself an inference under the standard that we apply on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case law that has ever said that where a juror's testimony is based on an inference, you don't necessarily assume the jury believed it. Sorry, where a witness's testimony. There's a pretty black and white rule that on appeal, you assume the jury believed all the state's witnesses and disbelieved all the defense witnesses. Now, I'm not saying that means that all reasonable inferences are eliminated here just based on that testimony alone. I'm just saying as part of your totality of the circumstances review, you have to assume the jurors gave weight to and believed Sergeant Yang's testimony because he was cross-examined. It was up to the defense to argue, don't consider that. Look at the videos yourself. The videos don't show that the appellant did this, but the jurors obviously rejected that. So now the question just is, when you look at everything in the light most favorable to the state, did the jury act unreasonably, essentially? And they didn't here. When you put all these pieces together, the jurors' verdict should be respected. I'll move on, unless there are additional questions about the circumstantial evidence, to appellant's second issue. And I do want to take issue with the claim that Sergeant Yang clearly implied that appellant had been threatened. Sergeant Yang just explained why some witnesses don't cooperate. And this court has read many, many criminal trial transcripts. And you know, the defense closing argument is often, the police did a terrible job here. They didn't follow all their leads. This was an incomplete investigation. Well, this testimony went to what the police did, how they did everything they could. It answered the juror's obvious question. Well, why isn't the other shooting victim here? Because some people just don't like to cooperate. Maybe it's because they don't want to be known as a snitch. There wasn't any implication that appellant threatened this victim or that someone did so on appellant's behalf. I mean, if somebody else was the shooter, presumably they wouldn't want this person to cooperate and clear appellant's name, because if appellant's cleared, then the investigation goes on. So there was no implication here that appellant did anything. And I don't believe the defense ever even argued that below. So Judge Harris did not abuse his discretion in admitting this evidence. And in any event, any error here was harmless because the key information here was the surveillance videos. the jurors were urged by the defense to watch those videos, make up your own minds about them. And the jurors did that. And there's no reason to think that but for this testimony about why witnesses sometimes don't cooperate, the jurors would have seen something different or not seen something in those videos. It's the form of the evidence that's important here. This wasn't a case that came down to credibility determinations about an eyewitness or something like that. We had hard evidence here in the videos. The jurors watched them. The jurors concluded that the state was right. When you look at all the videos together, they identify appellant and eliminate any other reasonable alternative that somebody else was acting with appellant's brother here and going to appellant's girlfriend's garage after the murder. So there was no error here. There was no abuse of discretion here. And in any event, it was harmless. And that goes equally to the target that came in as evidence. Appellant doesn't discuss that in his reply brief, but the target was relevant here for reasons set out in the brief. Judge Harris didn't abuse his discretion. The defense attacked the weight of it and had one of the witnesses say, well, yeah, it looks like these are bigger bullet holes than would have been used by the murder weapon. So the target ended up not having much weight in any event, but it wasn't an abuse of discretion to admit it. It certainly didn't tip the verdict in light of the surveillance videos. And that just leaves appellant's third argument that there was prosecutorial misconduct here, and any misconduct was harmless for the reasons I've already given, because this came down to what did the jurors think when they watched these videos, as the defense repeatedly urged them to. There's no reason to think that but for some of the things the prosecutor said, the jurors would have seen the videos differently. Appellant importantly does not claim that the prosecutors elicited inadmissible evidence through leading questions or otherwise brought information before the jury or inferences before the jury that were improper. And then that just leaves appellant's claim that it was prosecutorial misconduct to ask Sergeant Yang the questions about why witnesses sometimes don't cooperate. But Judge Harris expressly allowed that questioning. And I'm not aware of any case law that says it's prosecutorial misconduct to ask questions that the trial judge allows you to ask. So I still have a good 5 minutes left, but unless this court has additional questions, those are the points I wanted to make in response to appellant's reply brief and appellant's argument today. And I think ultimately this case just comes back down to the fact that the jurors watched the videos and concluded that in light of all the circumstances, there was no other reasonable alternative than guilt, and that verdict should be upheld.
Thank you very much. Mr. Getz, rebuttal.
Thank you. To briefly respond, Your Honors, as Judge Bryan, as you pointed out, there was no testimony here that the look was unique to Marcus Baker or that this was his look at all. These were very generic descriptive elements, including as the to the jacket. I think the only thing there was red color. That was the only similarity. But more importantly, that the state emphasized, well, Mr. Baker was the only one with a relationship to the person who had connection to the garage. First, I think the evidence is not true on that respect. You can't eliminate Brandon Baker of having a relationship with a Marcus Baker's ex.
It's Mr. Not Getz, if I could go back to your first point. It may be that Mr. Ragatz overstated it by saying that the evidence shows it was his look, but the evidence does certainly show that there were multiple videos that were viewed. Question on page 1239, are those videos that clearly show his face referring to Marcus Baker? Yes. Is it on more than one occasion? Yes. Is he ever seen wearing a gray hoodie? Yes. Is he ever seen wearing tan boots? Yes. And so they go through and they clarify that on these other videos where you can see Mr. Baker's face, the known videos, if you want to think of them in that bucket, that those were multiple times. It wasn't just a single known video. It was multiple known videos around the same time, right? So maybe he's overstated it to some degree, but I think the underlying point is still valid. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. The question is, how far does it take us? I mean, he did wear those clothes. I think it was maybe two videos were the total number that they had him on. And of course, corroborative of that, they found the gray sweatshirt. And I think there's two different pairs of tan boots that he ultimately was found to possess. But again, you know, who has gray sweatshirts and tan boots? That's, you know, there was nothing about these boots in particular or this sweatshirt in particular in either the videos or when they found it that they could say this is the same one. They're very generically similar on a very high, broad level. So to say it's a look, it's unique is not true. And it's also not true that Marcus Baker is the only one who had a relationship to the person with the garage. Deanna Hill had a more direct relationship, and we can't eliminate her. Brandon Baker, we can't eliminate him having a relationship with Marcus Baker's ex. The fact that a family member would continue to have a relationship with somebody's ex is not at all unusual. So we can't eliminate that. And I think exculpatory evidence related to that point is this garage door opener. If there was a garage door opener, what evidence was put before the jury that Marcus Baker possessed it on October 27, October 28, or any day thereafter? And the evidence to the answer to that is none. There's none. There's no evidence showing that he possessed that garage door opener. And if he didn't possess the garage door opener, because we know that somebody did to get in there, the only conclusion is somebody else had it. Somebody else, and it could have been Brandon Baker who had that with his connection through Marcus Baker's ex. So absolutely, we cannot say that Marcus Baker is the only one who could have had a connection to that garage. The other thing is when we talk about the descriptive element, consistent, and the testimony of Sergeant Rain, consistent does not eliminate a reasonable hypothesis of innocence. That doesn't take us very far. It certainly doesn't exclude the possibility, the reasonable possibility that the police simply identified the wrong or focus on the wrong person. And lastly, when you look at the testimony of Sergeant Yang, I would ask the court to focus on pages 1303, 1304, 1305, and 1306 of the transcript. Context is everything. And there's absolutely no doubt that the implication was that Wilbur Jackson did not testify because Marcus Baker threatened him. There's no other way you can read that, because the whole testimony from Sergeant Yang about why witnesses don't show up, it's all about being afraid.
But Mr. Getz, there was an objection to the testimony. The judge who issued the initial ruling in the motion in limine found that it wasn't a violation of the order because it was general in nature. So how do we conclude that that finding by the trial court judge is an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think you can conclude that, Your Honor, based upon the case law that I've cited, the MacArthur case, the Harris case, and then also the Clifton case, looking at those three cases. There was no reason for this fear or retaliation testimony to come in because you don't have Mr. Jackson's credibility at issue. The Clifton and those line of cases talk about that's when, you know, if a witness testifies and they change their story, well, on redirect, you can bring it out. Well, you were threatened, didn't you? Isn't that why you changed? Yes, but that's not what happened here. So there was no purpose. And I think the objection that counsel made included a 403 objection, and that clearly there was no probative value for that testimony at all. And under Harris and MacArthur, the danger that this would trigger an emotional reaction for the jury was very strong. Fear evidence is very powerful and it can be abused. The Supreme Court has constantly recognized that. And with all due respect to Judge Harris, he abused his discretion when he changed his mind and let it in. Thank you, Your Honors.
I want to thank both parties for their arguments today and their written submissions. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timeframe.